Okay, it's 1:30. If anybody must go right now, do so, because we're going to start the question and answer session. What we're going to do, we have two people with mics floating around the room, and so I'll point to who's next in terms of asking a question and get the mic. I encourage you, that mic is not working. Yep, there we go. Okay. And so I'll guide who gets up next. Please talk into the mic this way. They're very directional. So if you talk this way, we won't hear you. We are recording everything, so it's very important that everybody else can hear you as well as the recording. Okay. So with that, who has the first question? Anne?
There are some people over there.
Yep.
Yeah, I'm just...
Okay, yep, that's working. Okay, over there.
Peter is not allowed to ask a question.
Thanks very much for the talk. It's fascinating. I just wanted to ask you in pragmatic terms. You mentioned the question of mandatory minimums.
Right.
As a concrete thing that ought to be challenged and reformed. What would be, say, your top three additional pragmatic steps that you would recommend for criminal justice reform in Canada today at the federal level?
Well, definitely criminal justice reform, the mandatory minimums, the issues involving parole eligibility, which were completely clawed back and are demoralizing, and we've sort of removed from the conversation any concept of rehabilitation. And I think the last thing is that, you know, if you want a premier justice system, you have to invest in it. And that doesn't mean taking away preliminary inquiries. It is a profoundly under-resourced system. Both crowns and defense lawyers and judges work awfully hard for all of you. They really do. And it is profoundly under-resourced. And that is another place where I think we need to put some energy to modernize it. It's archaic how it operates.
And who has the next question? Anne, back there.
When you talk about can you hear it now? When you talk about alternative or different forms of justice for Indigenous peoples, are you talking about alternative courts? Are you talking about, could you explain what that would look like and if, how possible it actually is in this country?
Well, I don't know how. There are people who work on that and believe it is possible. But what I can tell you is from my experience in the system, that and visiting fly-in communities, that there is a profound cultural disconnect between what is happening in the courts, and it's not for lack of trying, and the people going through it. And so the cultural disconnect is extremely, extremely significant. It has no resonance. It has no connection to the reality of life. It has no connection to the culture. So now what we've got, we have some movement. For example, we have sentencing circles. And you can go to Old City Hall. There are some alternative ways of dealing with sentencing that are more reflective of that community. And so there's a little bit of that. But really where you see any reform, it's been on the Indigenous side, has been largely in sentencing with Gladue reports. That was the most significant thing. And the use of sentencing circles. Beyond that, we really haven't done a great deal to integrate our court system culturally. So I don't know. There are many who have spent their lives dedicated to it that take the view it is feasible to create a different court system or a parallel court system. But what I can tell you is the one we've got now is not working.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Thank you so much. This has been an incredible presentation, and I really enjoy hearing everything you've had to say. The Globe and Mail has been quite obsessed the last week with the SNC-Lavalin case, and one of the things that has struck me, because I had no idea this was the case, is that the position of the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice is held by the same individual. During your speech, you mentioned that the one and only requirement or obligation of the criminal justice system is to determine innocence and guilt. And I just wondered if this dual role that we're asking someone to play has an impact, and if so, what is that impact in practice on the ability of our justice system to make that determination of innocence and guilt?
Well, I mean, that position is largely consumed not with specific cases, but with the direction, the legislative direction that that a particular government wants to take. So they're not necessarily incongruous to have the same person perform the role, recognizing it is largely or substantially a political function. The people on the ground, the people who are lifetime prosecutors, are extremely independent and function independently in this country. So I don't know that the answer is to split the roles so that you have the political and then you have the person who's completely committed to the justice system, because that is really driven or drives legislative change, and that's driven by the political will of that particular party. Now, it used to be, I think, less political because legislative change was largely a function of law reform commissions and evidence-based thinking, but that's a thing of the past. That just doesn't happen anymore. So I don't know that the answer is to divide up the roles.
Thank you for a wonderful presentation. It was excellent.
Thank you.
My question to you is, could you comment on people of color who experience carding?
Who experience?
Carding.
Carding, oh. Yeah. Sorry. Well, our office actually was involved with that report with Justice Tulloch. So I don't know that everybody's familiar with what effectively it is, but in summary, it is stopping people to write them up, so you have a database. The police have a database that there's been interaction with the police. But what it's designed to do and what it does do in practice is to disproportionately affect the black community. It's a stop. It's a pretext stop often, and it's a harassment. It's like driving while black. And so that is the difficulty. Now, police officers have claimed that it is necessary to have this carding capacity and this database, but the most recent report has suggested that that is not so, and it is used in a highly racialized way to harass members of particular communities. But there is resistance to it, as you know, to removing it.
Sorry, get the microphone. Is it floating over in your direction? Oh, okay. We'll take the fellow with the microphone first, and then you will come second, sir.
I'd like to thank you as well for a very informative talk. I have a short point, which I hope is a correction, and then a related question after the point. You speak generally about how the criminal justice system negatively affects those who have been accused. And you speak about the numbers of people that are incarcerated for a length of time that they shouldn't be. But I think what you mean by people is men. And I think in terms of carding as well, you don't mean people. The vast majority of people that are discriminated against in those cases are men. The question that comes out of that is around what you talked about in terms of public denunciation of judges, and we find it here in Canada as well as in the United States. And there are two cases where I think it was appropriate, and I'd like your comments on them. The first is the case of Ryan, which is a Supreme Court of Canada case, a woman who had been videotaped trying to have her husband killed five times, was had her five charges stayed because, as the court found, she had been an abused woman based on her testimony alone. And the second is a case called Uriar, where a soon-to-be retired judge put together a manifesto claiming all kinds of theories from a feminist perspective, and I am a feminist, in order to convict an innocent man of rape. And I'm wondering if, on both of those, you'd mind commenting about whether it was appropriate for public outcry.
No, I am not going to comment on those two cases because the discussion is much more complicated than the question being posed. And it is not a correction that what I meant was men. What I meant is members of the community and accused persons. And if you were to draw a line, what you would see, and the thing that should be concerning, is not the discrimination that more men are accused of crime than women, but that the line of discrimination is drawn against racialized communities. So that's the question, and that is what I meant, and that is what we should be focusing on. So no, I'm not concerned that more men are charged with crime. There are all sorts of reasons for it, and I can assure you the largely male police force is not out there picking off the men of the community. They are, however, picking off the men of certain communities. And so I think it's the racialized enforcement and the racialized issues in our justice system that we should be concerned about. What's that?
I have a question relating to the jury system. I once served on a jury. Sorry? This way? Okay.
I'll repeat it. You once served on a jury.
Yes. And it was a very difficult decision. And
right.
The jury was very concerned that the person being charged would be overly penalized. We did have to come up with a guilty decision. But we were very pleased with the way the judge handled it. And I think all of the people on the jury probably appreciated the compassion that the judge exhibited in the sentencing process. And more recently, I was called to be on a jury. And both sides, the prosecutor and the defense attorney, used their maximum allowed number of peremptory challenges. Is that what you call it? I think so. And I think many people in the courtroom who didn't want to be on a jury and didn't understand the process and maybe never even heard the term peremptory challenges, I think as citizens we probably don't understand the jury system very well. And I'm just wondering if you could comment it from your expert point of view. Do you still have a lot of faith in that system? Do you think our society is supporting that concept as individuals and collectively as we ought to be?
Well, there is. It's very fundamental that we believe you should be entitled to be judged by your peers, by a jury of your peers. And so there is certainly value to us as a community to maintain the jury system. Just for those who don't understand what a peremptory challenge is, it means that you can excuse a person, a potential juror, from sitting without giving a reason. And so you don't have to explain why. Now, there are all sorts of theories about what will make up a good jury in a particular case. And there's actually a TV show called Bull, where there's a person who is a jury consultant, but the title of it is quite right. It is Bull. Jury consultants rarely get you anywhere, and everyone has all sorts of theories about what will make a good jury and what won't. But that's what a peremptory challenge is. And sometimes there have been cases here, and certainly many in the United States, where the peremptory challenges are misused to make sure the constitution of the jury is either all male or all white. And there have been cases that have been litigated around that. So that's where you have a peremptory challenge being used in an inappropriate or for an improper motive.
Thank you. I wonder if you'd like to comment on the process by which judges are selected and appointed I think it's an issue at the moment. You mentioned the justice system is essentially understaffed, and apparently we don't have quite the number of judges that we should have. So thank goodness we don't elect judges in Canada. But how much impartiality needs to be involved in the selection of judges, and should the government of the day, how much information should they have before they approve recommending a person to be a judge?
Well, the way that they judges are elected provincially is, or appointed provincially, is different largely than the federal system, which was overhauled to create a committee that vets potential applicants and then ranks them, but then ultimately it goes to the government to choose. So we do not have elected judges, and there is no transparency as to why one person is chosen over the other, but clearly the party that is in power is able to pick who goes on the court. But I think what we should keep in mind in Canada, and it's actually a very important point, is that when you look at the United States, the American Supreme Court is drawn right across party lines. It's very clear. You can mail in the vote, by and large, because it is very divisive based on politics and who you've been appointed by. If you take a look in Canada, that is actually not the case. Go back to the Harper government. They had a number of appointments to the Supreme Court of Canada, but their success rate in the Supreme Court was dismal. They kept getting beaten in the Supreme Court. And so our judges, which is maybe our uniquely Canadian temperament, tend to be profoundly independent from who it is that's appointed them. So you cannot draw that connection. And there are studies on it between what parties appointed the judge and how they'll vote, which is a great thing. They're very independent-minded here.
A lot of important cases are getting thrown out of court for delay. What's the problem and what's the fix?
Resources are the problem, and that's the fix. Resources. See, it's so easy. Getting rid of procedural protections is not the fix. For example, getting rid of preliminary inquiries, which are a very small percentage of the time in a court, is not a fix. But, for example, you have to go to court 6 or 7 times simply to set a date for a trial, often because things aren't ready. We are not computerized. It's quite extraordinary, actually. In some jurisdictions, you do it by phone or email. Here, we have 6 appearances, multiple appearances to set a date. And what that means is a full court staff, judges, lawyers, crown attorneys, all consumed. So to fix that, resources. But that is not... that's not feasible, and so what you do is you take away procedural rights.
Hi, thank you so much for your talk. I have 2 questions. So, can you hear me?
I can.
Yeah, okay. So you can pick your favorite or answer both, but I'll try to keep them quick. My first one is, when you talk about like the populist wave and clamoring at the courthouse door, how do you legitimately and honestly separate that from legitimate grassroots organizing around issues? And also, what would your advice be, or maybe language that you would advise for female politicians who are kind of already seen as weak if they want to champion compassionate justice reform?
Well, let me answer the first one, because quite frankly, I don't know the answer to the second one, because I think female anything is such a rough go that putting that on them as well is they have so many things to champion, not the least of which is themselves, to be successful in politics. I won't spend the next hour crying about Hillary Clinton or any other female that's ever run for political office. So let me deal with the issue that you've raised. I don't think it's right to conflate grassroots organizations with populist movements. Grassroots organizations, which have existed forever, are organizations that are connected to particular communities and the concerns, the specific concerns that community has. And those grassroots organizations often champion positions that don't get a great deal of airtime, that aren't the will of the majority, that are often neglected. And so grassroots organizations are extremely, extremely important. When I'm talking about populist movements, is this sense of the majority rule. And, you know, in that is a view, many political theorists would say, is a view that populist movements are more directed at sort of community concepts and are prepared to give up individual rights to achieve the will of the majority. And just saying it tells you the danger of it. That is the problem with a populist movement, where you're catering to the loudest group, the majority, and that is not what democratic systems are designed to do. It's actually the converse. It's to give voice to people who don't normally have that. So I don't think grassroots organizations are critical, but I don't think that I would conflate them with what I'm talking about, which is this populist majority wave that is seeking to drown out any contrary view or any view that is not the voting majority, as though the minority now becomes irrelevant. And you really see that being reflected in the political dialogue here and in the United States.
First of all, I thought that speech was fantastic, so thank you. My question is, I think a lot of people think that the way that sexual assault crimes are prosecuted is somewhat inadequate. Without taking away any rights from the accused, do you think that there's any appropriate reforms that could be taken in that form of prosecution?
Sure, and there are reforms that are being taken, and people in the justice system. Here's the thing I do want to tell you, is that when you put a group of defense lawyers and crown attorneys together and you sit down and say, what would we do to fix the system? We all tend to agree. We're not at odds. And so I go back to this, but resourcing is very important, because part of the most overwhelming thing for anybody involved in the criminal justice system, whether you're a victim or an accused, is it is so foreign to you. Now, an accused person has a lawyer there sort of navigating it and talking to them and taking them through it. A victim does not. And so that has been something that has been remediated to a certain point. One is we've got specialized prosecutorial teams that will carry a case from beginning to end. There has been some money given to have counsel appointed to be able to speak with and guide victims. But part of it is it's such a strange experience, and you don't know what to expect, and you don't understand what everyone's doing, and your expectations have to be aligned with what it is to do. I spend a lot of time managing my own clients' expectations. And so those changes are in effect and coming to effect. You've obviously got, and this is historical, back when I say historical, because I'm 6 years older than my brother, as you've heard, I'm talking about in the 80s, where you saw the Supreme Court roll back and remove a lot of legislation that was highly sexist. And then the courts or the parliament passing important legislation. So the evidentiary course correction, if you will, has been happening in the 80s and continues to today. There are cases being litigated about this. So there's a lot of stuff happening internally, but you need resources to do it, right? If you've got a crown attorney who's handling 20 cases, they do not have time to sit down and assist somebody to go through the system. So I think that is a very, very significant issue and hurdle and frustration, I think, for all sides.
Hello.
Hi. No, we're on. Okay. You've spoken, I don't know if I need to.
It's a very rowdy crowd here.
It is. You've spoken often of determination of innocence and guilt in the mandate. Oh, pardon me. You think I'd know by now. Innocence and guilt and the mandate defense counsel has in that regard. I'm pausing for a moment. Beyond that, when a client is facing incarceration, and so as an offshoot, our correctional system, as an offshoot to our criminal justice system, is in disarray, and the 10 years, C10, if you look at the GANS report, for example, and the lack of information going from courts, all the work put in by probation and parole officers, crowns, lawyers, judges, judges' comments, corrections not taking it up. With these issues and with the changes of legislation that you've referred to, is there anything that you do to assist clients that are facing or looking at incarceration to prepare them for for example, the CCREs, the CCRRs, when they're eligible for parole, how to apply.
My clients don't get incarcerated.
See, I've heard that before. And you are very effective, no question.
No, I'm joking. We do. But there are people, there are lawyers actually that are prison lawyers, prison law, lawyers, yeah. That we refer our clients to, and we get them ready if that is something they have to go through. That is not our area of expertise, but there are lawyers that are experts in all of that navigation, and it is a spider web. It's very complicated to navigate, so we send them to experts who do that area.
Okay, do you want to like the answer?
All right, dueling questions. All right, why don't we start with this gentleman who has the mic?
Sego, I'm Tahadinio from Six Nations Reserve, that Turtle Clan, that I'm also a graduate of Osgood nearly 30 years ago, more commonly known as Daryl Dockstader, who a classmate of Murray. That in light of the recent firing of the Attorney General and the notion of politics of criminal reform, what hope do you have when the first Indigenous woman with considerable influence in cabinet has now been fired?
Well, it is a very, very disappointing reality check of what the truth is. I think sometimes it's important for the public to understand the state of play because it's very easy to think everything's fine, and it's not, and I think that is a very good example. I think we should take some heart in the public reaction to it, which has not been supportive, and the desire to know more, and the quite correct comment that you make, that to have the first female Aboriginal woman in a significant position of power be demoted is not something that is sitting well with the Canadian people, nor should it. So I'm not an optimistic person by nature, I have to say, but here's the silver lining. Here's a silver lining, because I found one with Trump. Here is it. Here's what it is. I think to a certain extent we sort of plunk along sometimes and we think, oh my God, women are just doing so... I just took the Lord's name in vain. That's amazing. Sorry, Dad. we plunk along and we think, you know, women have all these rights. Isn't it great? We've come along and then you have Me Too and you say to yourself, no, we haven't come along as far as we thought. When you see Trump and how racialized America is and all of it being just ripped off and you can't look away, to a certain extent I say, well, that's important because we were sort of covering up and pretending everything was great now, and it's not. This is actually the true state of affairs. And so with this moment now where we were celebrating the first Indigenous woman, this tells us where we are. There is a lot of work to be done. And I think sometimes the public, I've given up on politicians, but I think the public needs that rude awakening a little bit to be brought back into action. So that's my silver lining of that. Not much of one, but the only one I'm going to hang on to now to try to get through my disappointment.
Christine, thank you for your remarks today. Return to this, the Jordan issue earlier. This week in Quebec, a senior executive of SNC, charges were thrown out against him for bribery because of the delay in getting his case to court.
Right.
There's an old expression in law, justice delayed is justice denied. My question to you is, would you like to see it incumbent on the accused to show demonstrable prejudice before a case against an accused would be thrown out?
Well, the Supreme Court has wrestled with whether or not prejudice is an element of it. And you have to understand that Jordan didn't drop out of thin air. So before we get outraged by Jordan, which is the delay case, you need to know that the courts had tried in Ascoff and in Moran, Supreme Court of Canada, to say, here's the framework, and yes, prejudice is a component of it. And governments were putting you on notice, you got to step it up, resource the system so people, everyone involved in the system is tried in time. By the time Jordan came along, it's been years and years and years since Mr. Ascoff and Mr. Moran and the Supreme Court had said, you got to do your duty to the politicians. They did not. And so what Jordan does is say, okay, we're not wasting any more time. There are no more chances. Here is what it is, what we think is reasonable, and what is outside that framework. And so we simplify the threshold. And so, no, I don't think it's incumbent upon an accused to show prejudice. And, in fact, in the United States, it's a pretty hard and fast rule that you are required by statute to be taken to trial in a certain time period, and if not, it's game over. And so that's what the Supreme Court did. But you have to always look at it in context. It was a response to many years of this cry to step it up falling on deaf ears from the politicians. So we've simplified it. It's now very easy. And there's a very easy solution. I know you want me to give it to you. Resources.
We have time, by the way. Cool. Am I on, Peter?
Yeah, hi there.
So are we at the last question here? Or?
No, no. This, and then we'll have one more question after that.
All right.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I just wanted to thank you very much for coming with your family today on a Sunday.
I was worried no one was going to show
okay.
up, so at least.
That's why I came. Your brother is my neighbor.
Uh-huh.
And I'm an older sister to a Peter as well.
Ah,
but
okay.
I've got 8 years over my brother. There's so much that's so discouraging, and I have to really find silver linings all the time because I'm despairing over so many things, especially Jody Wilson-Raybould and the racialized communities. And I very much appreciate what you said about that because really that is our burden in this.
It's a crime.
It's a crime, okay? So on a lighter note, since your brother was an actor and tonight is the Oscars in the name of his son, is there a movie that you would recommend, since we love movies with lawyers? And there's so many fabulous movies, but I watch so much crime, and I'm always trying to solve the cases. Is there a lawyer that you see portrayed, either in Canada or in the States or, you know, globally, that really looks like a true criminal lawyer, that isn't fabricated or made, you know what I mean? Like, it is a real person that you could look at and say, yeah, that's the way it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, contrary, I always tell people, contrary to what you see on TV, female lawyers don't end up having nervous breakdowns, sleeping with the judge, juror, or their client. No, unfortunately, I don't think you actually do see a good representation. I think you have to go back a bit to Inherit the Wind with Spencer Tracy, but he was representing or depicting Clarence Darrow, so a real-life person. Everybody loves To Kill a Mockingbird. But here's the truth. I mean, I don't care. Legally Blonde is good enough for me. I'll watch anything. Anything that involves law. I am a complete law junkie, so I'll watch them all. But I think if you sort of want to go back to the days where lawyers were respected and what they did in the system was valued, we had a step back a long way. There's nothing now. Which just doesn't mean I don't watch it. I watch it all.
This on? Okay. Not really looking for a comment here, but you had mentioned about the tremendous power of the state And kind of on behalf of all Canadians, I'd like to thank you, because I think what you're doing in the Norman case against what I view as a Stalinist show trial and unbelievable abuse of power is just marvelous. So thank you very much.
Thank you.